Well, the difficulties I think we have, and all people perhaps, is understanding what it would be like to live in a different culture. That's true in our world. I have a hard time imagining what it must be like to be a Christian in India today, or in Nigeria, or even in Mexico, in the Ukraine, in Indonesia. These are all places where I have friends or acquaintances, missionaries, native peoples who are there working for God and professing faith in Jesus, and in hundreds of other places, dozens of nations, almost literally 200 nations where churches of Christ exist today. We just know about how it is to live here. We're used to our buildings and our air conditioning. Hard for us to imagine being in Indonesia where that in some of the areas like Irian Jaya, their church buildings have thatch roofs and are pointed. Or in places like Sudan and Ghana in Africa, where that their church buildings just exist of poles sticking up with a flat roof over it and open sides, where people walk to church, sometimes 2 to 3 hours to get there. And so the church meets for 2.5 or 3 hours because they won't be coming back that night. And they won't be coming back on Wednesday night. They just meet once a week because of the difficulty of so many to get there to be a part of it. And yet dynamic, evangelistic, excited, growing churches in places like that. How much more difficult might it be for us to imagine what it would be like to be a Christian 1900 years ago? Not only do we have to somehow transport ourselves and our minds to another part of the world, but we have to go back in time. We have to start taking away all the things that we just take for granted almost anywhere in the world today. Electricity, communications, telephones, automobiles, none of that. As we continue our study tonight about the history of the church, we want to talk about what it was like, at least in some ways, at the beginning of the second century to be a Christian. And we'll have another lesson where we'll talk about how they worshiped, as far as we know, and how they taught and what they were taught and how the church practiced. That'll be for another lesson, but I just want to talk about what it was like to be a Christian in their culture. And what we know the most about by far, of course, is their culture, the Roman Empire. We know Christianity had spread way beyond the Roman Empire, down into Africa, over into India, up into what is today the remains of the former Soviet Union, but we don't have any historical records to speak of what Christians were like in those places in the year AD 100. We do have records of what it was like to be a Christian in the Roman Empire. First of all, we know that they faced some challenges, and again, most of those are for another lesson, but we know that as a Christian, they faced sporadic persecutions, both by the government and by local people, sometimes other religious groups, sometimes the governor of a region or the mayor or the leaders of a certain city, and at times by the emperor himself and the official Roman government. We know they faced the challenge of false teaching that was starting to spread among the churches. As soon as the last of the apostles were gone, there weren't people speaking with the same kind of authority about what the truth was. And that gave a door of opportunity for false teachers to start multiplying and cause division and starting leading people away and misleading people about the truth and so forth. But even with that, it wasn't the dominant thing happening in the church, but it was happening. They faced a certain amount of rejection and misunderstanding by the people around them who were not Christians. It's amazing when you start hearing what early Christians were sometimes accused of. They were accused of being very ignorant and superstitious. Now, they were accused of that because to the average Greek or the average Roman, anyone who didn't believe in the gods, these people must be really ignorant if they don't know there's gods up there. To think there's just one God, how dumb is that? You know, that's literally how people thought. To us, that sounds opposite. Today, we think of people who believe in many gods as being the ones who are ignorant and unlearned. In their culture, in their day, to believe in just one God meant you were thought to be ignorant and unlearned. their beliefs that Jesus died on the cross for their sins was considered ignorance. How foolish in the minds of some people to think something like that. The belief that he rose from the dead was also thought to be a superstition. Something that people who believed in that obviously don't know how the world works. People don't rise from the dead. So if you believed in that, you must be a very ignorant, superstitious person. The fact that they would not refer to the emperor as Lord God the Emperor, they would not offer sacrifices in worship to the emperor, meant that they were often accused of being disloyal to the empire, that they were actually maybe somehow planning some kind of overthrow of the empire. And so they were always looked upon with suspicion in the best of times and persecuted in the worst of times. The fact that they regularly practiced something that when their neighbors tried to understand it better, all they could get out of the Christians was that they came together and ate the body and drank the blood of their founder. They were often accused of being cannibals. People couldn't understand what they were trying to tell them about what we call the communion or the Lord's Supper. They were accused of being cannibals. The fact that they taught loving one another and that there was an equality within the church, and so all people were loved and accepted alike. Christianity was often rumored to be full of all sorts of perversities and all kinds of wickedness that would go on inside of their secret meetings. Almost like the so-called free love movement in our country in the late 60s and 70s. Christians were often accused of all sorts of perverse things. When, as far as we know, by all accounts, exactly the opposite was the case. They were accused of being antisocial. When they were having big holidays and big feast days in their cities in which they were honoring the gods and would have these big sacrifices, then everyone would sit down to eat and drink and get drunk and party. Christians wouldn't take part in that. They were antisocial. They held themselves separate. They wouldn't practice many of the common things that the people around them were practicing. Now, truthfully, we can see today what was going on, what Christians were really doing and what they were accused of. And we know the roots of all of this is in the New Testament itself. The whole thing about cannibalism obviously has its real roots in the commemoration of the death of Jesus and the Lord's Supper, the communion, the Eucharist, as it was also called in very early days. But some of these other things had real roots, had real truth to them as well. For example, Peter, in his letter of 1 Peter, is writing to Christians right at the very beginning of the first persecutions. And even though he's writing probably 40 years before the end of the first century, the beginning of the second, nevertheless, he's already previewing what's coming. And so, for example, in 1 Peter chapter 2, in verse 11 and 12, he said, "Dear friends, I urge you, as aliens and strangers in the world." See, antisocial. Christians were actually taught to be separate. "I urge you to abstain from sinful desires which war against your soul. Live such good lives among the pagans that though they accuse you of doing wrong, they may see your good deeds and glorify God on the day He visits us." What about this thing, Peter, that already people are saying y'all are disloyal to the emperor and you won't respect the government? "Submit yourselves for the Lord's sake to every authority instituted among men, whether to the king as a supreme authority or to governors who are sent by him to punish those who do wrong and to commend those who do right. For it is God's will that by doing good you should silence the ignorant talk of foolish men. Live as free men, but do not use your freedom as a cover-up for evil. Live as servants of God. Show proper respect to everyone. Love the brotherhood of believers. Fear God. Honor the king." Already twice in that passage we hear Peter saying something about the foolish and ignorant talk of outsiders and what they'll be saying about Christians. Now later in his letter to these Christians, he says in 1 Peter chapter 4, and in verse 3, "For you have spent enough time in the past doing what pagans choose to do." living in debauchery, lust, drunkenness, orgies, carousing, and detestable idolatry. And they think it strange that you do not plunge with them into the same flood of dissipation, and they heap abuse on you. So already Peter's warning the Christians that by living their separate lifestyle and holding on to their faith, that they were going to be the targets of abusive talk, of ignorant words, and of persecution. And so that was the case. But the rest of the time tonight, I want to focus on some of the positive aspects of living at the beginning of the second century as a Christian. I found a very interesting article by a man that he talked about that from the very incomplete records we have of that period of time, say the beginning of the second century, AD 100 up to AD 300, so from our very fragmentary records, it is reasonable to draw the conclusion that overall Christians lived longer, healthier lives than non-Christians did. And the reasons for that were several. One of them is their lifestyle. They did not participate in a lot of the things that would end up shortening the lives of people. Bad habits, bad practices, even sexual practices and pagan practices that were connected to their worship of their gods that actually led often to the spread of diseases and other things. Christians didn't do that. And so their practice personally protected them from some of that. But secondly, and a real major one, was the care and concern that Christians showed for each other that was not typical in the pagan world. They lived longer, healthier lives, both because of their practices in terms of their lifestyle, but also in their practice in regard to treating each other. Christians had been taught from Jesus himself and everyone's after him that they were their brother's keeper. In about AD 200, a church leader by the name of Tertullian wrote that the pagan temples spent their donations on feast and drinking orgies, while Christians spent their donations to support and bury poor people, to supply the wants of orphans who were destitute of means and parents, and to take care of old persons who were confined to their homes because of age and health. What a contrast. The other religious houses of worship in towns would take the monies that people were donating at those places and turn around and invest it in various forms of immorality, or public drinking orgies, or great feasts in which all sorts of immorality often accompanied those who were present. In AD 251, we have a letter that was written by one of the leaders of the church in Rome. He's writing to one of the leaders in the church in Antioch, but he mentions in the course of his letter that more than 1,500 widows and distressed persons were being taken care of on a regular basis by the congregation just in Rome. They cared for people. Certainly the model for that is found as early as Acts chapter 2. As soon as the church is founded, right away, what do we see the church doing? We see that the church was, Acts 2 and 45, selling their possessions and goods they gave to anyone as he had need. Every day they continued to meet together in the temple courts, and they broke bread in their homes and ate together with glad and sincere hearts. And that's repeated several times, not just in the next several chapters of Acts, but throughout the book of Acts. Even toward the end of the book, we find Paul coming back to Jerusalem in Judea with a contribution that had been taken up among the churches in Asia Minor and in Greece and in Macedonia to help the needy in Judea and in Jerusalem. This was a characteristic of the early church, and it continued well on into the following centuries, that the Christians saw their responsibility to take care of each other. Those who had means would care for those who had no means. And in sometimes it even meant a great personal sacrifice to those who were doing the giving. That's why Paul would say, like in 2 Corinthians chapter 8, He says in verse 2, out of the most severe trial, their overflowing joy and their extreme poverty welled up in rich generosity. For I testify that they gave as much as they were able and even beyond their ability. Now, you know, by the world's accounting, when someone is in deep poverty and has great joy, you add those together, that does not add up to an overwhelming contribution. But it did in the Christian community. Their great joy dictated that they took, even when they didn't have enough for themselves, take and give generously to help Christians somewhere else, because they believed in taking care of one another as the Lord Jesus Christ had taught them. Even after this bishop in Rome was talking about how many the church in Rome was taking care of, there was an emperor, he was often referred to as Julian the pagan. He was one of the last emperors that was not a Christian, so this would put him up into the 400s. But he complained in a public proclamation he made that those impious Galileans support not only their own poor, but ours as well. He was railing against the Romans in the city of Rome that they weren't taking care of their own poor, and they were leaving it to the Christians to take care of them. They were taking care of their own plus the pagan poor. And so this really gives us a little set of snapshots of how these Christians really looked out to take care of one another. And in many cases, those outside of the faith as well. During the second century, around AD 161 to AD 166, a great plague swept through the Roman Empire. The emperor during that time was Emperor Marcus Aurelius. And the Roman armies had just won a very significant series of battles and therefore a war against some of the barbarians. But in coming back into the society of their day, they unknowingly brought back with them a plague. It's thought today by historians that it probably was smallpox. Over a period of about 5 or 6 years, some 25 million people, it's estimated, in the Roman Empire, more than 30% of the total population, died from this plague. And a standard practice among the pagans when a plague or something like this broke out in the city was to avoid all contact with the sick. And if you started exhibiting some of the symptoms of whatever this plague was, then you could expect your family to put you out and lock the door and leave you out on the street. And that was understandable in their mind, because it's better for you to die than for the whole family to die, you see. Even though they didn't understand about how disease spreads and all of that. On the other hand, the Christians during this great plague of the AD 160s were known throughout the Roman Empire as those who would go out during the night with wagons and pick up those people who had been put out by their own family members and take them home with them and care for them. Many Christians died, just as many probably as the pagans. But while the pagans showed little mercy for their own sick, the Christians not only cared for their own, but even for the pagans during this great plague. Things like this put Christian social values and the value they placed on human life on public display. And so while there were on the one hand these rumors about what Christians believed and practiced, that many people ended up being very prejudiced against them because of it, these kind of things often drew very positive attention to the Christians in AD 100 and the years after that. But in addition to this whole idea of being their brother's keeper, there was a very different treatment of the social strata within Christianity. In general, in the ancient world, everybody lived on their own level. Everybody of a certain language, of a certain race, they tended to live separately from others. If you were women, you were treated differently than if you were a man. If you were a citizen, you were treated differently than if you were just a resident alien. If you were a slave, you had no rights. If you were a servant or a lower class worker, you had only a few. If you were of the aristocracy, a patrician, then you had all the power and authority. Not so in the Christian church. The Christian church taught from the very beginning that in Christ everyone is equal. That God loved the whole world so much that He gave His only begotten Son. And that Jesus died for the lowest slave and the highest emperor and everybody in between. And so from God's perspective, there is no levels. And that's by and large what the church practiced. We saw in the ministry of Jesus what a prominent place women had. That was not true in their culture, but it was true in Jesus' ministry. Throughout the letters written by Paul, we hear women being mentioned over and over and over again by name. Not only as just being a part of the church, but being participants in very significant things going on in the church. This was not characteristic of their culture. This was characteristic of the church. And about AD 112, we had a letter that was written by the governor of Bithynia, I believe it is, which is an area that's in the eastern part of what is today Turkey. And he's actually writing a letter to the emperor, Trajan. And he's asking the emperor, what should he do about these people called Christians that he finds within his area of governance? And while he's waiting for an answer from the emperor, he goes ahead and says, while awaiting an answer from you, let me tell you what I am doing. He said, I consider them a very superstitious people and believing in something different than what intelligent people believe. And so I often take them and torture them to find out what they really are doing. And some of them will give up their faith, and those I let go. And the ones that will not give up their faith, I execute because they're so stubborn. Now, to our mind, that doesn't make much sense, does it? You know, if someone believes something strongly enough, they won't give it up. Well, then kill them because they're stubborn. Or if they will give it up and renounce their faith, then I'll let them go. And as he's talking about this with the emperor, he says, among those that I have treated in this way are two women who are prominent among the Christians here, who are servants in their group. And the word servant he used by our modern translations would be the word deaconesses. So even then we see that women also were participating in a very public way in the church. Sociologists estimate that about in AD 100 that there were many more men in the Roman Empire than women. That was for a number of factors, but two really played a very prominent role. One was, there's a very common practice in Roman and Greek households that if a girl was born into the family, they threw her out. She was put outside to die, exposed to the elements. Whereas if a son was born into the family, then he was cherished and taken care of. So this, over a period of, you know, many years, gradually increased the male population and decreased, percentage-wise, the female population. Christians didn't practice that. Secondly, abortion was a widespread choice in their culture. And so if a woman became pregnant and she or her husband, more especially, did not want to have a child at that time, they practiced a medical form of abortion, but it was not safe. Large numbers of women died as a result of these attempts at abortion. And so you had... I saw one number that said something for every 100 women in the Roman Empire, there were 130 men on average. And yet in Christianity, it was almost reversed. There were many more women than men. First of all, the gospel seemed to find a ready audience among the women. But secondly, Christians, as the churches became second and third and fourth generations of believers, not practicing the same things that their culture is practicing, it tended to reverse a lot of the bad results of what was going on in their culture. And what was true of women was also true of slaves and those of the very lowest class. While slaves had practically no rights in the Roman Empire, in Christian communities, slaves who became Christians were treated on an equality with their owners. And even with the wealthy in the congregation. James tells the story at the beginning in the book of James, chapter 2. He talks about if a rich person comes into your assembly, you say, here's a fine seat right up front that you give him. But if a poor person comes in, you tell him, well, you can go stand over there in the corner, or you can sit here on the floor. James condemned believers who practiced that kind of thing and said, if anything, they should be doing just the reverse of it. And so that kind of teaching found in the New Testament had carried on into the following generations of believers. And so not only did you have slaves treated on equality with their masters and even with their owners, in many congregations with time, elders and bishops in the church were from the slave class along with those of the wealthiest class. They didn't pick their leaders based upon their social position, their education, or their money. They picked their leaders based upon who was qualified to lead the church. And so it's amazing how often slaves ended up as elders in the church in the second century, because they had turned the whole thing about their culture and their stratification of people based on race and language and gender and social status and all that thing all upside down. You know, that very interesting comment in the book of Acts. And of course, I know they were speaking in part at least about something different, but in Acts chapter 17, in Thessalonica, this would be a part of the Macedonian and therefore the Greek, what's left of the old Greek Empire. When Paul and others first came into Thessalonica preaching the gospel, it says in 17 and verse 5, but the Jews were jealous, so they rounded up some bad characters from the marketplace, formed a mob, and started a riot in the city. And they rushed to Jason's house in search of Paul and Silas in order to bring them out to the crowd. And when they did not find them, they dragged Jason and some other brothers before the city officials, shouting, these men who have caused trouble all over the world have now come here. Now, that's how the NIV puts it. I think it's in the King James Version. It says, these men who have turned the world upside down have now come here. And truly, socially, that's what Christianity did. They turned everything upside down. Those who were of no account in the general society were of great value in the church, and those who were held in great honor in society were held of no greater value than others within the church. And so there was this great emphasis on equal treatment and equality within the church. This unifying kind of subculture that the church then created, created little communities all across the empire. And it meant, first of all, that those out in the culture who would take the time to look at Christianity and perhaps have the faith shared with them by someone within the Christian community would find some aspects, maybe even many aspects of the Christian faith very attractive. Because if they were people of without any kind of franchise, without any kind of special position out in the culture, in Christianity, they would be treated much better. They would find that more attractive. But more than that, it was very attractive for those who are already within the Christian community, because wherever they went, they could find believers who not only believed what they did, but also practiced what they practiced. And they would find help and comfort and hospitality in the scriptures toward the end of them. When you get into things like 2nd and 3rd John, I believe John mentions in both of those little letters of his how Christians were very hospitable towards strangers when they came into their community. And that's what Christianity was known for. It was Christians knew that if they had to make a business trip or because of economics or something, had to move from one place to another, if they could just reconnect with the Christian community in the new place, they would find the same kind of acceptance and support system they had in the place they came from. And that was very attractive. And that's what was a part of what it was like to live in Christian community in that time. Now, the persecutions had a very interesting side effect. They normally think that, you know, if someone's been persecuted for what they believe, that that's going to going to cause the number of adherents to that particular faith to decrease. First of all, that didn't actually happen. Oh yeah, the persecutions took place, but the decrease in numbers did not. The fact that people believed in something so strongly that they were willing to die for it, even when the might of the whole government was being brought down upon them, that really attracted other people to them. Because the Roman Empire was going through a period of time in the AD 100s in which there was very little that was certain. It was a time of great military upheaval, social upheaval, economic upheaval. We've mentioned the great plague that took place. There were famines, there were earthquakes, there were other kind of natural disasters that that period of time was marked by. And people found attractive something that was so sure in the minds of these people that they wouldn't give it up no matter what. But the second thing that happened with persecution is it tended to weed out those who were not true believers. And it tended to not attract people who weren't really committed to it. It meant that by and large the leaders that the church had in AD 100 and the period of time after that were of excellent quality. They might not have been the most educated. They might not have been the most socially high ranking within their communities. They might have just been slaves. But there's one thing for sure. They were doing what they were doing because they believed in it, not because they were power hungry or were seeking some kind of special position or something like that. Because every time a persecution broke out, the very first people the authorities went after were the leaders. And yet every time a leader was taken away and thrown into prison or executed, there was always another one there to take his place. So you had very high quality leaders. But even the average church member, by and large, was not a part of the Christian community because of what he was going to get out of it. There were not a lot of freeloaders. They were not there because of the handouts. It was too dangerous to be there for that reason. One social historian writing about that period of time in the Christian community says, anyone who has participated in a cause that demands great sacrifice will understand that services, talking about the worship services and public services of the churches, will understand that services conducted in those early house churches must have yielded an intense shared emotional satisfaction. Shared risk usually brings people together in powerful ways. Because they knew they lived under the threat of persecution and even went through persecutions. Then when they came together to worship, there was this great release of knowing they were with other people who believed like they did, and they drew support from that. That was true early in the church as well in Acts chapter 4 and 5 when the apostles come back from having been thrown in jail and being threatened by the authorities and so forth. When they come back to the other believers in Acts chapter 4, it says in verse 23, on their release, Peter and John went back to their own people and reported all that the chief priests and elders had said to them. And when they heard this, they raised their voices together in prayer to God. And at the end of their prayer, they said, now, Lord, consider their threats and enable your servants to speak your word with great boldness. So they found a unifying factor, even in the persecution. And they found great strength from being together with others who had the same faith they did. I've already mentioned in part that a church that gave so much and asked their members to give so much, those members then knew they could also receive so much should they need it. They knew that if they needed aid, they could find it. If they were sick or dying, they knew they would be cared for by their brothers and sisters. Not only were they told they needed to love others and accept those of all other social strata, they knew they would be loved and accepted that same way. And while they were told that women, slaves, people of other races and various social status were all equal, then they knew they would be treated equally as well. They not only learned what it was like to act like a Christian, but they also learned why you did it. The teaching of the early church was very vigorous and very specific about man and God and their relationship to each other and how they therefore should treat each other. And one of the key words of the early church was mercy. They had received mercy from God, so they extend mercy to others. And that was in stark contrast to their culture, because many classical Greek philosophers, as well as Roman philosophers, had taught that mercy was a character flaw. And with time and education, you could overcome it. And yet in Christianity, it was held up as one of the great virtues among those early believers. For them, the good news was not just that God had sent His Son into the world to die for their sins and they could have a right relationship with God. The good news also was that they could have a completely different way of life if they came to faith in Jesus. That's something of what it was like, as far as we can tell, to live in AD 100. A place where people cared for others in spite of persecution. They looked out for the needs of others. They stood up for their faith. They died for their faith. They had great leaders, great teaching, great communities. And people knew that if they had to travel from Antioch to Rome or from Alexandria to Thessalonica, that when they got there, unannounced and unknown, that if they could just find the Christian community there, that they would be loved and accepted and provided for. That those believers would do everything they could to help them. And in turn, if those Christians came to where you lived, you'd do the same thing for them. There's great lessons in that for us. Kevin has announced an invitation song for us. The gospel is supposed to change our lives. Not just our view of eternity, but our view of life here on earth and how we treat other people. We've heard just a little tiny bit of that tonight. But if there's any way we can help each other as our lives continue to change and our examination and reflection of the gospel, then you can come and let us know what we can do to help. You can come and do that now while we stand up and sing the song.